He put his hand on my knee and then he started touching my leg. He tried to put his hand in underneath up my leg into my shorts, which he couldn't do. And that's when he undid my, like my zip and my clasp and pulled my shorts down. And then he started fondling me. And at the same time, he then grabbed my hand and made me touch him on top of his trousers. And at this stage, there was a knock on the door, and then somebody walked straight in, looked, saw us in there, and then walked straight back out. And then that was it, it was over. He said to me, "Don't you dare tell anybody about this. Nobody will believe you because I'm King Jimmy."
If you are unaware of who and what Jimmy Savile was, it would help to note that he was a television presenter and radio DJ by profession. He was a committed philanthropist by reputation who raised £40 million for British charities. He was a household name in the United Kingdom. He was beloved by millions and mourned by just as many when he died in 2011 at the age of 84. He was honored by many organizations, including the British government and the royal family, when he was knighted. That was how thousands of Britons remembered him, as he was mourned during the funeral, which was observed by thousands and brought his hometown of Leeds to a standstill.
Sir Jimmy Savile's funeral cortege today took him on one final trip round his home city.
He said he had done it all, seen it all, got it all, and if I might add, given it all.
On his headstone will be the epitaph he wrote for himself. It reads, "It was good while it lasted."
There was another side to Savile, a darker side. Many who procured some one-on-one time with him report being sexually assaulted. You see, Jimmy Savile was like the Joker, except instead of killing people, he raped them. Just like the Joker, he wore a colorful, flamboyant wardrobe, and his demeanor was equally colorful and flamboyant. He was like a clown without makeup. Like the Joker, Savile hurt many people, and not only did he feel no empathy for the victims and no remorse after he offended, he thought it was all very amusing. That's Jimmy Savile in a nutshell, the clown prince of rape. His fundraising for medical institutions and educational facilities proved to be a ploy to gain access to England's vulnerable sector. For decades, Savile violated the ailing, the infirm, the disturbed, and the innocent. Due to his fundraising endeavors, he acquired connections in law enforcement agencies and close relationships with the administrations of educational and medical facilities. As a result, the victims' appeals for justice were dismissed and ignored. This kept Savile out of handcuffs so that the pipeline of donations would not run dry. It was only after he died when victims of Savile came forward and spoke publicly. When they came forward, they said things like, "His eyes were cold and dead," and "That vile tongue, tasting of cigars, went right down my throat. He was a bad, bad man."
Duncroft. Home office approved school for intelligent but emotionally disturbed girls. Until Jimmy Savile came along, it was the safest place I'd ever been. We used to laugh and giggle about whoever had been out in his car, you know, the things that he did and made us do. We'd say, "Oh, he's a dirty old man," and we'd go off into screams of laughter. And we'd tell each other what had happened that day.
Before I knew what had happened, he'd stuck his tongue into my mouth. It didn't seem to bother him that other people could have seen. Looking back now as an adult, I realise he'd been grooming me by calling me at home and arranging to come. He was trying to take advantage of a 14-year-old child.
I remember the funeral, just not watching it.
which was bizarre, because you sort of think, oh, I should be relieved that he was dead. But at that time, I didn't realise that what he'd done to me, that he'd done to other people.
Well, actually, I was sort of cross that, you know, I couldn't, like, give him a slap round the face. It was very sad that he died before he was found out.
It was all Savile here, there, all the time. And you thought, when's this man going to go off? Avoid it. That was what we did. Avoid, avoid, avoid.
I couldn't watch it. I just spent the whole time I can't listen to what anybody's saying, because that face is there and there and there and there again.
I hate him. I wish he was alive so that he could be punished. I wish he hadn't died.
The legacy of what he did bothers me every day.
I need to share now, and I need to talk now.
Back then, it never occurred to me to say anything. Oh, who was going to believe me? Who would believe me?
He promised me that if I gave him oral sex, that he would arrange for me and my friends to go to Television Centre and be on his television show.
Stoke Mandeville Hospital's got a chapel that we used to attend every Saturday evening. The times when Savile came, there used to be a little room, and it was my job to go in there, get the collection plate. When I went into them rooms, he would start touching and pushing his fingers inside me and doing whatever he wanted to do in that little five-minute space. He knew what I was. He knew that I was... he knew I'd been abused for years. Not, you know, we do this, we have our own little gang of your eyes go down to the floor, your body language of hold yourself, you know, you're quite tense and you... They know that. You know, it's there. For people who that's what they get off on, they know. They know who you are. They know you've been primed, you've been touched. Because straight away, we know who they are. I knew who he was. I knew what he was. I didn't expect ever to love a man, not in my whole life.
I had to go to the head porter. There was Jimmy Savile, sat there, laid in the chair in his office. And he came up to me and said, would you like to go for a cup of tea? I've got to go to my mother's house. And we could have a cup of tea there. And sort of being a bit starstruck and a bit curious, I thought, oh, okay. Yeah, why not? Off we went in his white Rolls Royce. He pushed me back, undressed. I think he might have seen the look of sheer horror and shock on my face. And he says, don't worry, I've had a vasectomy. And I just froze. And I did actually say, stop this, I don't want it. And he didn't. It was very cruel. I thought I somehow asked for it. Until about 2 or 3 years ago. Now, I get so depressed. I had anorexia as well. I had absolutely no confidence in myself. I hated myself. I just felt I was branded.
The man once so beloved by the British public as a tireless humanitarian, as the host of the popular children's show Jim'll Fix It, and the teen favorite, Top of the Pops, was exposed as a serial rapist and pedophile. An entire country had been duped. Here's how it all happened. Jimmy Savile was born James Wilson Vincent Savile on October 31st, 1926, in Leeds, West Riding of Yorkshire, England. As a young man, Savile already knew that there were three key things he most wanted in life. And he was determined to get them by any means necessary, money, fame, and sex. He would stop at nothing, as the British public would find out after his death. Savile was ruthless in his pursuit of gratification. He refused to allow obstacles like ethics, morals, justice, personal boundaries, and human rights to stand in his way. This was reflected in a quote evaluating what he considered to be the failures of his father, who was an honorable, if not prosperous, man. He called his father scrupulously honest, but scrupulously broke. Young Jimmy was determined not to carry on his father's legacy as a man whose heart was bigger than his bank balance. His journey as one of the titans of British show business emerged from humble beginnings. During World War II, he was conscripted to work in the coal mines. Savile and others working in his position were dubbed Bevan Boys. He carried his weight well enough in this unglamorous profession, but his days in the mine were short-lived. Savile incurred injuries to his spinal cord due to a shot firer's explosion, which was followed up by an extensive convalescence. Savile didn't return to the coal mines after he recovered. For a time, he made his living as a scrap metal dealer. Savile's introduction to show business came when he became a DJ in dance halls in the early 1940s. Up to this point, it was most common to hire bands. Savile opted to play records instead. He claimed to be the first dance hall DJ to use two turntables and claimed the concept was his invention. Though this claim has been disputed, in 1929, the BBC Handbook featured an illustration of twin turntables, and they were advertised as a set in Gramophone magazine in 1931. Savile eventually made his way up to the highest echelons of power in the nightclub and dance hall world. He is reported to have begun having sexual relations with underage girls at this time, with and without consent. His management style reflected more of Savile's dark side. He established a reputation similar to that of a mafia capo, having dealt with unruly patrons by having them savagely beaten by the club's bouncers. He spoke of this practice with pride and expressed no regrets, even when the punishment was out of proportion with the crime. Savile also established a career in amateur sport. He competed in bicycle races, marathons, and wrestling matches. Though he seldom outmatched his opponents, he attracted attention for his outrageous clothing and behavior. He wore brightly colored clothing that was often mismatched. He dyed his hair different colors, though later in life he would stick with white. Though many who interacted with him professionally and socially considered him an obnoxious buffoon, few would have argued that he knew how to make an impression, and he was seldom forgotten. No matter what event he involved himself with, all eyes were on the man wearing the peculiar clothing and sporting the strange hair coloring. He didn't care if he won or lost sporting events. It was all about being seen. It was also about being documented in the papers. And he was. Savile's flamboyant appearance and demeanor made an attraction out of him at all the dance halls he worked. And one night at the Palais Dance Hall in Ilford, he was discovered by an executive from the music imprint Decca Records. Radio. In 1958, Savile's radio career began. He was a DJ at Radio Luxembourg for the next 10 years. He presented programs with his listenership peaking on Saturdays with an audience of 6 million. During the early 1960s, he became one of England's most widely recognized DJs. Eventually, he moved to BBC Radio 1. He would continue to host radio programs off and on up to 2007. Television. Jimmy Savile's debut as a television presenter was as the host of the Tyne Tees Television music-based program entitled Young at Heart, which aired for the first time in May 1960. Always keen on getting all the attention, Savile dyed his hair a different color every week, even though the show was shot in black and white. On January 1st, 1964, He presented Top of the Pops for the first time. The show's popularity endured for decades, and Saville hosted it for the last time on July 30, 2006. In the 1960s, Saville was the go-to man to present pop music-oriented programming. He presented the broadcast of the New Music Express Poll Winners Concert. On December 31, 1969, he hosted Pop Go the 60s, a show that summarized the pop music legacy of the preceding decade. Saville's popularity as a television personality led to miscellaneous one-off presenting jobs, such as television specials, public service announcements, and commercials. Saville won the hearts of the nation's children when his show Jim'll Fix It went to air, becoming an instant hit. Children would write letters to the show detailing a wish they had made, and for a select few, Saville would make the wish a reality. The show was so popular, it lasted from 1975 to 1994. His image to viewers was established, and it was double-pronged. He was known to teenagers as an ostentatious goof who would do anything to get attention. To children, he was a kind-hearted soul who delighted in bringing happiness to children who longed for the realization of their dreams. However, an appearance on Dr. Anthony Clare's radio program In the Psychiatrist's Chair in 1991 would give the public a glimpse of Saville they didn't expect. With just a few words, Clare provided British viewers of an X-ray of Saville's psyche in a published transcript of their interview that was released in 1992. From what Clare observed, Saville was, quote, a man without feelings. He went on to say, there is something chilling about this 20th century saint. Indeed, many who knew Saville, intimately or not, have remarked that they could not discern any genuine emotions in him, and that the personality with which the British public was so familiar appeared to be a product of performance art. It was a friendly and inviting package, but the contents within were not fit for human consumption. Sex crimes. Jimmy Saville made many personal appearances throughout his career in show business. Like most entertainers, he furnished the organizers with a rider, that being a document that outlines items and circumstances that the personality requires in their private quarters. They insist on the criteria laid out on the list to feel comfortable and enjoy the event on their end. The following is a list of conditions Jimmy Saville submitted to event facilitators and expected to be fulfilled down to the last letter. Make sure that my normal fee of £200 goes to a charity. I wish to sleep the night on the Chevin in a tent, which you will organize, plus sleeping bag and large torch. A guard of honor of 6 young ladies in another tent, of course, to keep me safe. A trip round the local hospital. The presentation of some kind of municipal honor, framed drawing or painting of the township. Some cigars and matches. Now, why would a former pro wrestler need 6 young women to protect him? If you think that sounds suspicious, consider also that when probed for particulars about the girls in question, he would always tell them, the younger, the better. It never occurred to the event's organizers that people are seldom in the market for bodyguards with the profile of a 15-year-old girl. Nevertheless, he was adamant about these conditions, telling them, no girls, no tents, no me. A girl who agreed to these conditions and spent the night with Saville and 5 other girls after one such event reported the experience. She was 17 years old and not the youngest female in the group. All the girls slept in one tent. In the early morning hours of the following day, Jimmy Saville, who had been plying the girls with vodka for hours but abstained, entered the tent and, quote, tried it on with all the girls. The girl telling this story wouldn't elaborate, but the impression of Jimmy Saville she took away, quote, disgusting old man, and, quote, a pervert. The next day, she and the other girls posed for a newspaper photograph with Saville. As she recalled of the experience, I was just thinking, get me out of this shit. I was out of my depth. It was horrible. Saville relished the time he spent working on Top of the Pops, for the show provided him with a fertile crop of teenage girls. When the band Status Quo appeared on the program for the first time, singer Francis Rossi was invited by Saville to his dressing room. Saville led the way, saying, "Come and see me tarts. Some fucking tarts we've got in." If you listen closely, you can hear the sound of Sylvia Edwards being molested by Jimmy Saville during a taping of Top of the Pops. This is her take on the event.
He couldn't do anything because there was all people around and we were on steps and he was there and I couldn't move because there was too many people around and the camera was right up in front of us. So no, I couldn't get away. I told the man that was next to the cameraman and he just told me to get lost. He said, "That's just Jimmy, go away." His hand was there just groping. Yeah. And it wouldn't move. Yeah. I was embarrassed because all I could think of was people were watching.
Yes.
And you just don't know what to do. You know, I'm trying to go like this, but he just wasn't having any of it. He would not move. You know, if they keep letting people do things like that, it's going to get worse. It's not going to stop.
Mm.
Well, I mean, I went and told my father, but that was all. But I did tell... Well, I just presumed that they would say something, but he didn't. He just told me to get lost. The BBC needs to be held accountable for it and allowing it. They say that they, you know, they've denied it, but they can't not have known what was going on. I think they all need to be named ashamed if they're still there, but the fact is they can't just keep covering up high-profile people that do things like this. You know, a lot of people went, you know, got worse than I did.
Yeah.
But, you know, they can't just keep allowing it and they can't just keep dismissing it, that they don't see it. I did say, I wonder if they would have, if it would have been any of their children, whether they would have been different.
As the median age of the audience rose, underage girls still managed to infiltrate the audience on a regular basis. Producer and director Stanley Dorfman has stated that he never saw Saville with a girl at the Top of the Pops studio. In fact, he didn't see him interact with many people at all. According to Dorfman, Saville rarely, if ever, socialized with the guest stars, producers, and members of the show's dance troupe, Pan People. Not in the studio, not even at the BBC bar. From what Dorfman could tell, the Jimmy Saville BBC viewers were familiar with was a facade. To quote Dorfman, he was an absolute enigma. It was like he'd come in every week playing the part of Jimmy Saville. I had no indication of what he was like at home, and I didn't bother to find out. Perhaps Jimmy Saville didn't mingle with Stanley Dorfman because he wasn't a 15-year-old girl. If Saville was discreet with girls at the BBC, it was a pattern of behavior he was sure to break whenever an opportunity to be alone with a teenage girl presented itself. A member of Saville's fan club who was identified under a pseudonym when documented in a book about him knew this all too well. Jill, as she called herself, recalled a call one day in the summer of 1970 when she was 19 years old and living in Brighton. The man informed her he was Jimmy Saville's chauffeur. He told her Saville was making a personal appearance at Worthing Town Hall and he wanted to meet her. Jill was a member of Saville's fan club and had written a letter to him 2 years earlier. She agreed to meet him. Once Saville spotted her, he put his arm around her and marched the two of them to his motor caravan. He locked the door once they were inside. As she recalled, he was standing up, and it was weird. He said to me, "Oh, you're a beautiful little dolly bird." And he said, "I'd like to lock you up in my cupboard and take you with me everywhere I go." And I sort of just looked at him and thought, "What is happening here?" Then he said, "I could buy the house next door to your house, and I'd be very happy." He kept saying, "I'm the strongest man in England." And I remember I just looked at him and thought, "This guy's a nutter." Then it happened so fast. He was on top of me. I was back on the bed and Jimmy Saville was on top of me. It was literally a fight. He was trying to rape me. He shoved his hand in my trousers. He had an erection. He shoved his hand under her skirt and molested her. Next, he demanded to know if she was on the pill. She told him she wasn't, and he became angry and shouted, "Why not?" After 20 minutes of struggle, Jill pulled herself free. She made a mad dash for the door. Saville asked her if she wanted to be a dancer on Top of the Pops, and said she could take something from the caravan as a souvenir, a keepsake of his attempt to rape her. She took a small crucifix with a deer at the foot. She kept it even when she reported the incident in 2007 to the Sussex Police Department, and later still when she told the story once again to a Crown prosecution lawyer in 2012. Early in 1971, 15-year-old Claire McAlpine, better known to the staff of Top of the Pops as Samantha Claire, was found dead by her mother, Vera. She committed suicide by swallowing 2 bottles worth of sleeping pills. She left a diary behind that was read by Vera, who discovered that Claire had been exploited by personalities at the BBC. Claire confided to her friends that she was willing to have sexual relations with stars of the BBC that would get her on television. Not only were DJs and presenters having sex with groupies, but they even took photographs of them. Jimmy Savile, when asked to comment on Claire's death, denied having relations with underage girls. He conceded that he had dated women from the show, but insisted that they have tea with her parents. This he did, though with far more nefarious purposes. He would seduce the parents and win their trust before molesting or raping their daughters. It's a common play in the pedophile handbook. Dennis Garbutt was the driver of Saville's motor caravan at the time. He was a patient at Leeds General Infirmary when Saville offered him the position. He lasted a year before quitting, as his wife put it, in disgust. Saville would say to him, "Go and get a cup of tea, Den." That was Dennis's signal to leave the caravan and take to the streets so that he could leave Saville to his business, which usually involved a young girl. There was a double mattress at the rear of the caravan. Dennis confided to his wife that many of the girls Saville lured to the caravan were as young as their daughter, who was 12 at the time. One such girl who hailed from this age demographic at the time when she was assaulted by Saville in the summer of 1972 was Dee Coles.
I think it was just before I was 15, so I was 14, on holiday with my mum in Jersey. And the hotel we were staying in, he had a camper van, quite a large camper van. My mum and I were dead close. We would do lots of silly things together. She was like 40 when she had me, and she really, really wanted the best for me. So she sent me to private school. She'd given up a lot for me to be able to do that. The path was set then that I was going to go on to college and go to uni. I was definitely going to be a teacher. Done really well in my exams. And she said, "You and I are going away for a week, where do you want to go?" I suppose it's quite indicative of the fact it was the 70s. Like, Jersey was abroad and exciting. Yeah, and I chose the hotel. God. We were at our table. My mum and I. People had dressed for dinner, definitely, at this hotel, and he just wandered in like gold shorts and a vest. And so immediately you look, and the cigar. He sort of worked the room, circulated and speaking to everyone, and came to our table. I thought it was exciting. My mum thought it was incredibly exciting. She really did get, you know. She was really starstruck. It was the next day that the assault happened, the next morning. There was one other girl about my age staying with her mum and dad and brother, so we sort of hooked up. It had a back door through the car park to take you to the beach, and that's where Saville was staying, in his motorhome in the car park. So he wasn't actually staying in the hotel. He came out and got this girl to take some photos of me and him. The first two, he's really pulling me into him and sort of thrusting his leg between my legs. And it's, I can tell when I look at the expression on my face, I'm like, not comfortable with it. And then the third one, I do remember because he said, oh, he took his vest off and got me to stand behind him. So I was more relaxed in that one because he wasn't like pushing into me. And then we got invited in to see the van. And it was as different as night is from day, just totally, totally changed. Locked the door and pulled me towards him. You know, I think sometimes when people read about abuse, they just think, oh, it's the same as adults having sex, but it's with a minor. And it really isn't. It really wasn't. So I didn't tell my mum what had happened, but I couldn't stand the fact that she was still sort of chatting with Savile. He was still in the hotel and she was still talking to him. And I thought, you must know there's something wrong with me. You must see that. And I don't know. I just really hated her in that moment. It's her job to take care of me, and that hadn't happened. I couldn't tell her. Oh, God, I couldn't tell her. And, it's only because she's dead that I was able to come forward when I did, speak out when I did. I wouldn't want her to have that image. It's almost like, oh God, this is dramatic, but it's almost like it broke my heart, so why should I break hers with it? I sort of think once was one heart was enough.
He forced Dee's hands down the front of his pants. It was my first introduction to the male body, she said. So the whole thing was just an incredible shock. After it happened, he tried to get us back in the van a second time, and my memory is that for me, it was the end of the holiday. Looking at the photo that was taken with Savile, Coles laments about how innocent she was before the incident. There was no way any of my friends or I wore makeup or got dressed up to go out on the town. We were quite naive. It's always going to be a shock to anyone being sexually abused, but the innocence just disappears as soon as something like that happens. It saddens me greatly to think that so many other children suffered sexual abuse from Jimmy Savile. As a 14-year-old, you don't have the thought that it might be happening to anyone else. While Savile's victims were relieved that somebody came forward to disclose their incident of abuse, not everybody was pleased with what Dee had to say.
Hazel in Froome in Somerset says, I'm disgusted that everyone is trying to shoot Jimmy Savile down. Jimmy spent his whole life helping other people. He did so much good work. Leave him alone.
All it's doing is maligning a man who, over so many years, had raised well over £40 million for charity.
I'm just surprised that they waited so long to say it. If this is true, why did they not report it to someone beforehand?
And then it just grew and grew. And with that growing, I guess lots of things come out of people having opinions and not everyone being understanding.
One more caller, Jinky is in Burton-upon-Trent, and says young girls have always thrown themselves at DJs and pop stars.
These people absolutely disgust me. They need to really get the facts right. All this is a sensational one.
That I would be blamed, that somehow what happened to me wasn't real. I was making it all up. I don't know why I thought that, but I was making it all up. It wasn't real. And I wouldn't be believed at all.
The caravan was the site of many of his sexual offenses. The same caravan that was parked outside of Buckingham Palace the day the Queen designated him an officer of the British Empire. One of Savile's BBC radio shows was entitled Savile's Travels. Savile took to the road and interviewed people from coast to coast. A producer once related a story about when Savile had his way with a young fan in his caravan. An elderly woman approached the producer, who was sitting on the rear step of the vehicle. "Where's Jimmy?" she asked him. "He's gone already, I'm afraid," the producer lied. Meanwhile, the caravan was bouncing on its axles. "Oh dear," the woman continued. "Well, please, will you give him this from me?" She handed him a jar of marmalade. "I made it myself. It's for Jimmy, to thank him for everything he's doing for the young people." If only she had gotten the complete picture of everything he was doing for and to the young people. Students of Duncroft Approved School, an institution for girls with mental health issues, saw another dimension of his impact on young people. He would take his favorite girls for a drive in his Rolls Royce. Perhaps the attraction for them was the temporary taste of freedom they got from the sojourn in Savile's car. Attracting the exclusive attention of a national celebrity may have made them feel special. Either way, many of them were happy to accompany Savile to wherever he was headed. Once out of sight of Duncroft and its no-nonsense headmistress, the girl's hand would be forced down Savile's pants, his tongue in her mouth, and his fingers in her underpants. He told them he had an instinct for knowing who was a virgin. These car rides were a test of the girl's likelihood of reporting him. In return for their silence, he offered money in a post office account, a job at a nightclub in Bournemouth, or a trip to the BBC. There was another stipulation in this verbal contract. He required oral sex, or as he was fond of calling it, a Jimmy special. If they complied and became nauseated, he would stop the car and demand that they vomit on the ground. He would also inform them that if they didn't cooperate, they would ruin things for the other girls. That meant no more visits, no more free cigarettes, and no more trips in the minibus to the BBC, where they would have gotten to meet some of his showbiz associates. Worst of all, he would tell everyone who was responsible, and it was highly unlikely that the needle of accountability would be pointing in his direction. These girls were wayward youths who had been involved in petty crime, and only the worst was expected from their conduct. The staff of Duncroft would find it easy to believe that one of their students had engaged in sexual acts with a man inside of his car. What they would find hard to believe is that it would have been instigated by one of England's best-known philanthropists. Savile had this down to a science. To quote one Duncroft girl who had her own encounter with Savile, "He did it in such a way that he always covered himself. You knew it was your word against his, and you would never be believed. He manipulated situations. We were vulnerable and in need of love and attention." Savile associated with all of Britain's most well-known pedophiles. While taping the series Clunk Click, singer Gary Glitter, a.k.a. Paul Gadd, appeared as a guest. On the air, Savile asked Glitter, "Do young ladies go to great lengths to get next to you, as it were?" "Yeah, and I go to great lengths to get next to them." Glitter then took a look into the darkness to inspect the females in the audience. "I'm having a look round the audience now to see if there's anyone I fancy." Decades later, Glitter was charged when he was discovered sexually abusing minors under the age of 12 in Asia and for downloading child pornography. A joint report by two law enforcement agencies completed and submitted in January 2013 indicated that Savile's offending reached its peak from 1974 to 1975. 15 sexual assaults were reported in each year. Even while staying at Henlow Grange Health Farm in Bedfordshire to prepare for a marathon, he couldn't help himself. Claire was an 18-year-old chambermaid at Henlow Grange. Savile asked her to serve him breakfast in his room. He started on her with lewd comments about her breasts. He followed up by groping her. This went on until one day when he switched gears. Claire opened the door to his suite to find him naked and spread eagle on the bed with an erection. As she recalled, I felt disgusted and humiliated. I tried everything not to be sent to his room again. As traumatized as Claire was, many of Saville's victims experienced worse. In 1977, a 12-year-old who shall remain nameless was admitted to Stoke Mandeville Hospital to have her tonsils removed. Stoke Mandeville is a hospital Saville raised money for. He was also given extensive access to its facilities. He had privileges that even many of its own staff did not enjoy. Instead of being placed in the children's ward, the girl was situated in the geriatric wing. The story is most effectively told in her words. I remember being bored and asking one of the nurses if I could go into the day room to watch television. I imagine she was glad to agree because I had been making a nuisance of myself on the ward. The nurse directed me to a day room, which was a short walk down the corridor. I was wearing a flimsy homemade nightdress that came down to my knees with a dressing gown over the top. I was of a very slight build, and my hair was in two pigtails. As I went through the ward door on my way to the day room, I saw a skinny man wearing a long coat. He was also wearing brown tracksuit-style trousers. By this I mean the trousers that he was wearing had no buttons or a zip. He had white to blonde shoulder-length hair, and he was wearing heavy rings and a gold chain around his neck. He was smoking a cigar. I didn't recognize the man at the time. The man asked me, "Where are you going?" I recall that it was difficult for me to talk because my throat was sore. I said in a very croaky voice, "To the television room." The man said, "I'll show you," and he walked me down the corridor. I can't recall what the man said, but he was friendly, and I felt comfortable in his company. I recall that as we walked along the corridor, the man opened a door which led to a room that contained a mop and bucket. Looking back, I realized that it must have been a cleaning cupboard. The man gave a short laugh and closed the door without going in. Almost immediately afterwards, we arrived at the day room. As we arrived at the day room, an elderly man was leaving, and I saw that he nodded an acknowledgement to the man who was accompanying me. The day room was a small room with a black and white television, which was stood on a low wooden table. There were a number of identical chairs in the room and an armchair. I went and sat on one of the chairs. The man said to me, "Have you got a boyfriend?" I didn't answer because although I had boys who were friends, I didn't understand the concept of a boyfriend. The man then leant down in front of me and positioned his body so that he was between my legs. I remember that he had a distinctive muggy odor. The man was gentle, almost caring. As he pushed my legs apart, I saw that he had pulled down his trousers. Not all the way, but sufficiently to expose his penis. I recall that his penis had a distasteful smell. He then maneuvered himself forward, and as I remained seated, he inserted his penis into my vagina. I didn't feel threatened by what he was doing to the point that I recall touching his cheek with the palm of my right hand. His cheek felt very clammy. The man's penis was only in me for a short time. He then made a groaning noise and ejaculated. He withdrew his penis and pulled up his trousers. His semen had gone all over the seat I was sitting on and over the inside of my thighs. He then wiped me and the chair with the front of his white coat. Having done so, he stood up and without saying anything, walked out of the room. The door to the room had been open throughout what happened. I have a distinct memory of getting off the chair and going to the doorway of the day room and watching the man as he walked down the corridor. I watched him until I lost sight of him when he went through some double doors at the end of the corridor. What happened just seemed surreal. I was in shock and unable to put into context what had happened. I felt disoriented and walked back to the ward. I seem to remember initially I couldn't find my way and went to a couple of other wards before I found mine. I hadn't been gone very long. The whole thing happened very quickly, probably no more than 15 minutes. As I went back to the ward, I sent to the nurse who had given me directions to the day room, "Your porter hurt me," and the nurse said, "Where?" I couldn't tell her, so I pointed to the area of my vagina. She said, Don't say anything. I'll get into trouble. Having received this response, I just went and sat on my bed. It was difficult to describe how I felt. I understood what had happened and that it was wrong, and I felt strongly that I wanted people to know. I waited for the nurse, who I had just told, to become involved with the patient, and I went over to her desk and got a pen. I took out 2 pages of a Bible, which was in my bedside unit. The pen I had taken didn't work, so I returned to the nurse's station and got a pencil. I wrote on one of the torn-out pages, "To the doctor, your porter hurt me. Please ring my dad." She also wrote down her father's address and phone number. "I then signed the page," she continued, "and I posted the sheet of paper in a letterbox that was situated in the corridor beyond my ward. I remember reading the word, letterbox. The box was red and it was high up. I remember I had difficulty stretching up to post the page. I thought at the time I was posting the note to the doctors at the hospital. The very same night of the rape, I was in bed after the lights had been turned out. Although the ward was dark, there was a partial light. I was half asleep when the same porter who had assaulted me earlier in the day came to my ward. This was the first time that I'd ever seen him on the ward. He was wearing the same clothes as he'd worn earlier. I saw him walk straight to my bed as if he knew exactly where I was. I was frightened, and I pulled the covers over my head. I could smell the same muggy odor that I'd smelled on him earlier in the day. The man stood to the left of my bed, and without saying anything, thrust one of his hands over the covers and positioned it between my legs. Although he didn't insert his fingers, he rubbed it on my vagina. I heard him make a sound as if he was enjoying what he was doing. He touched me in this way for only seconds, probably 10 to 20 seconds. I remember that his movements were rushed. Again, I was really shocked by what was happening and didn't know how to respond. I kept my head under the covers throughout. Just as suddenly as he had appeared, he removed his hand and walked away from my bedside. As he walked away, I peeked my head out from under the covers and saw that he'd walked over to the bed of an elderly lady. As I watched him, I saw him literally jump on top of the woman, so he was lying face down on top of her. As he did this, I heard a nurse shout, "You shouldn't be in there, Jimmy." I saw that he got off the lady and walked out of the ward. Nothing further was said. The next day when I woke up, I noticed the woman who occupied the bed opposite me had gone, and I didn't see her again. As a result of being assaulted by the porter on a second occasion, I decided I wanted to make sure that the doctors were aware of how the porter was behaving, so I wrote a second note, again on a page torn from the Bible in my bedside unit. I wrote exactly the same message as I had the day before, and posted the note in the same letterbox. Later, during the course of that day, I decided to try to find the porter. I don't know what I intended to do. I left the ward and made my way to the corridor. I'd watched the porter walk down after he'd raped me. I walked down the corridor myself and through the double doors I'd seen him go through. I went into a bar where people were wearing white coats. I thought they were all doctors. They were sitting at tables, drinking and smoking. As I walked into the room, one of the men said, "You shouldn't be in here," and he escorted me out. I couldn't see if the porter who had assaulted me was in the bar or not. I went back to my ward and didn't say anything further to the staff about either of the incidents, and I cannot remember anything more of my stay in hospital. When I was 14 years old, I was watching television, and I saw the porter who had assaulted me in hospital. I recognized his voice to begin with. The picture on our television was of poor quality and quite distorted. I was amazed to see the man was the porter from the hospital. I was sure of it because I recognized him visually and his mannerisms. His voice was very distinctive. I couldn't understand why the porter from the hospital was on television. In time, I came to know that the porter was Jimmy Savile, but I remained confused at that stage about the situation. Almost as shocking as Savile's assault on the girl was the cabal with which the staff of the hospital had eagerly coordinated and maintained. They had decided that the funds Saville raised for the institution were more important than the health and safety of its most vulnerable patients. Indeed, the culpability for Saville's assaults on the patients at Stoke Mandeville Hospital did not reside with Saville alone. Without the assistance of the staff, he may not have been able to offend at all, or at least with the same frequency. Just like with the police, politicians, and the royal family, Saville had everybody fooled. Novelist William S. Burroughs once said, "Word begets image, and image is virus." His image as a committed philanthropist infected people of influence in the highest echelons of power, and the strongest symptom was the way in which it impaired their vision of Saville. Had they been able to see him clearly, they would have known about the ways in which he preyed upon the powerless, who in some cases were as young as 5 years old when it was their charge to protect them from people like Jimmy Saville. To be fair, not all the staff at Stoke Mandeville were complicit. Many of the nurses complained about how Saville kept touching patients. John Lindsay of the Thames Village Police recounted a statement made by a nurse who worked there. She said to me at the time, they didn't like Saville because he was touching little girls in hospital. Not necessarily in a sexual way, but touching them, and they were unhappy about the way he was going on. They told the little girls who were in hospital to stay in bed and give the impression they were asleep. When Lindsay reported this to one of his superiors, the reaction was disheartening. Jimmy Saville is a high-profile man. He must be okay. He could not be doing anything irregular. Don't worry about it. Nothing was done about it, and Lindsay was powerless to act any further since he needed authorization to do so, and it wasn't granted. Even when Saville began to sexually harass the nurses, nothing was done. Their complaints, as everybody else's, were met with derision and even ridicule. This kind of institutional abuse culture was also rampant at the BBC. In 1986, a 19-year-old woman filed a complaint with Merseyside Police about sexual abuse she suffered at the hands of Jimmy Saville and others at the BBC's facilities. She reported that a family friend, who at the time was working as a cameraman at the BBC, had abused her in his home. It was through him that she was introduced to Jimmy Saville at BBC television headquarters in West London. She was 9 years old. This so-called friend of her family led a lamb to the slaughter, as she recalls. I can remember him taking me to see Saville in a room with a table, a mirror, a wardrobe, and a couple of chairs. The cameraman called him Uncle Jim. Saville sat in this high-backed chair and asked me to sit on his knee while he signed my luminous pink autograph book. I was wearing a pink dress with my hair in pigtails. As she put it, he sat her, quote, right back on his body, whereupon he proceeded to molest her. The cameraman was in the room at the time, she continued, but he didn't do anything. He took me to see Saville another 2 or 3 times, and then left the room. I can remember he was bony and he stank. For the next 2 years, on a weekly basis, she was taken to the BBC and was sexually abused by over 30 men. The abuse destroyed her life. She has suffered from mental health problems for many years, which have led to suicide attempts. Her mental health issues destabilized her life to such a degree that she lost custody of her children. Merseyside Police insist that their response to her report was dealt with, quote, appropriately. In other words, as with so many other of Saville's victims who reported his offenses to the authorities, her allegations were not taken seriously and an investigation was never initiated. According to rumor and speculation, his abuse wasn't limited to the living. Saville was fascinated with death and frequently discussed it at length. As he once said, I find I've got a great aptitude for dead people. Indeed, the dead rarely object to how they're treated. Yes, Saville was quick to dispense an A grade for his own work as an amateur mortician. However, staff at Leeds General Infirmary and Broadmoor Hospital, who were employed there at the time, report that his work with the dead was far more lascivious and perverse than they ever admitted to the general public. He was allowed to visit the mortuary unsupervised after befriending the chief mortician. A quote from an official investigation into his activities at the mortuary deemed them to be, quote, not within acceptable boundaries. They reported that Saville committed the following acts with corpses. He stole glass eyes with which he intended to make jewelry. He performed oral sex on them. He would push male and female corpses together in sexual positions and take photographs. Sometimes he would insert himself in between the cadavers and have himself photographed in compromising positions. It's not to say that cracks never appeared in the solid wall of protection Saville constructed around himself, a wall supported by the powers that be in every faction of society. In 1998, a letter was sent to New Scotland Yard by a party that chose to remain anonymous. They claimed to have been, quote, closely involved with Jimmy Saville. According to this source, Saville was a homosexual and a, quote, deeply committed pedophile. He further related an incident wherein Saville had become extremely angry and frightened when a rent boy blackmailed him for an undisclosed sum of money. Saville changed his phone number as a response. The rent boy in question told him that if he didn't get the money he demanded, he would go to the media and report Saville's pedophilia. He also noted that Saville owned numerous articles of pornography at his home, though he did not offer details about the images contained therein. This is the closest Saville ever came to being brought before justice. If only the rent boy in question knew how much heartache he could have prevented by reporting Saville's activities to the police and testifying against him, the media would surely have accomplished more to this effect than the police. It was an open secret within law enforcement agencies that Saville was a pedophile. As a police constable intimated under cloak of anonymity to the Mirror newspaper, there wasn't a copper in Leeds who didn't know Saville was a pervert. Though this was common knowledge among officers of the law, there was never enough evidence to charge and convict him. It also didn't help that many of the people who lodged complaints, either about their interactions with Saville or about his conduct with others, were not willing to testify. It was only after his death in 2011 that Saville's offenses were exposed in earnest. Tim Hicks and Nigel Ward were reporters for the news website Real Whitby. In October 2012, they began to research allegations that Saville was a member of a pedophile ring. The ring operated around the vicinity of oceanfront arcades in Scarborough from the 1980s onwards. To quote the first story, senior police officers had concerns that Jimmy Saville may have been involved. It went on further to say that a number of pedophiles were operating as a unit in Scarborough, including a man who abused children at his caravan overlooking the seaside resort. In an interview with Dan Davies, author of the book In Plain Sight, The Life and Lies of Jimmy Saville, which was published years after Saville's death, Saville told him about the caravan he kept parked a few miles down the coast from Scarborough, and that he had taken girls there. The police had also noted that many of Saville's close friends were members of the ring. Saville's sexual offenses have made lasting impacts on their victims. In many cases, the long-term impact of the trauma has inhibited their ability to find happiness or even mental stability. As a girl who was raped by Saville in 1977 told a child protection expert, being raped by Saville has had a profound effect on my life. It has reinforced the feeling with me that I am a victim. I have come to see myself as someone who was born to be abused. One boy suffering from debilitating chronic pain was masturbated by Saville while the boy's mother's back was turned. Due to his fundraising activities, Saville was granted access to areas of Leeds General Infirmary that were off-limits to many staff and other celebrity visitors. After raising £3.5 million for the facility, he was given three offices, staff to open his mail, and provide other clerical services. Most important to him, though, it provided ample opportunity to indulge in abusive and inappropriate contact with patients and staff. 60 people came forward to report such experiences. The statistics: amount of victims who were patients, 33. Amount of victims who were children, 19. The time frame, 50 years, 1959 to 2009. The age range of his victims, from 5 to 75. Number of arrests, 0. Number of charges laid, 0. The earliest 1959-era report of Saville's offenses involved the rape of a 13-year-old girl. After that, he attacked patients in corridors, canteens, staircases, and then in dressing rooms of every section of the BBC campus. He raped a virgin teenager in a hotel. He raped a 15-year-old intern he met in the BBC canteen as they met for tea. 21 of Saville's female victims were aged 15 or younger. The youngest was 8. He also preyed on young boys, which included an 8-year-old. A legacy of evil. Ian, a man who identified as Ian, reported being abused by Saville at the age of 12 at a National Health Service children's home. As he puts it, he had his childhood stolen by Saville. He has struggled in his intimate relationships with women, leading to a great deal of personal destabilization. It was like my childhood had been stolen, he continued. All those good jobs, relationships, and experiences I missed out on. Saville abused him when the other boys visited home for the weekend, and he was left alone with Saville. Bedtime became a period of significant turmoil for him, and he was too terrified to report Saville to the authorities for years. Though Ian has always loved sports, he avoided phys ed in school because the very thought of undressing in front of his classmates horrified him. Ian dropped out of school before completing his diploma and pursued a life of alcoholism. His income came from social assistance, and he had frequent brushes with the law. These are all typical after effects of childhood abuse, making of Ian a statistic. His intimacy issues were long-lasting. He was a virgin until he was 30, and did not have a steady relationship with a woman until he met his wife at the age of 32, which was 20 years after he was abused by Saville. Despite all the pain and suffering Saville has caused him, there is one thing he wants to make clear. I don't want to be seen as a victim, as one of Saville's boys. He has kept this dark secret to himself for the most part. As he relates, apart from the officials and a counselor I saw a couple of times, I haven't told my friends and family. The only person who knows the truth now is my wife. Kevin was 9 when he was forced to perform oral sex on a friend of Jimmy Saville's, while Saville watched and laughed. He was also physically and sexually abused by Saville and another man while en route to BBC Studios to attend a taping of Jim'll Fix It. On one occasion, he was being sexually abused by Saville when another man walked into the dressing room. The man simply said, "Oops," and left, unfazed. That wasn't the end of that incident, though. The man walked into the room and carried on the abuse. He made me do stuff to him, and he physically abused me as well. He hit me. People have asked me, a couple of friends who know about it now, have asked me why I didn't say it all at the time. My parents are listening to this now. How can you tell your mom and dad that you were forced to give oral sex to somebody, and then they physically hit you afterwards? And Jimmy Saville there laughing. Cook said the second man punched him in his head and tried for another swing, but was prevented from doing so by Saville. As Kevin reflected while speaking with BBC Radio 5 Live, I'm shocked by the amount and the time it's gone on, and the amount that's gone on. I'm lost for words. Caroline Moore. Caroline was 13 years old and recovering from surgery on her spine at Stoke Mandeville Hospital in 1971 when Saville tried to force a kiss on her. She's just as horrified by Saville's long legacy of abuse as she is by what he did to her. I'm absolutely shocked that it has been going on for this long and that there are so many victims. It's scary that so many people knew and yet said nothing. There are still so many unanswered questions. I can't believe that he was allowed into the places that he was. The authorities need to get their act together and make sure nothing like this can happen in the future. A lot of people should be ashamed of themselves. I find the whole thing terrifying. You don't think about people high up in society, such as presenters and celebrities, carrying out such attacks. But the fact that Jimmy Savile was respected meant he was actually more dangerous. I'm quite a strong person, but the extent of what he did scares me. Ms. C. A former student of Duncroft Children's Home, Ms. C. told Surrey police in 2008 that Savile took her hand when she was 15 years old and placed it on his groin to arouse himself. He did this in a dark television room in the school. She remembers the year as being 1978. It occurred soon after she was discharged from the hospital. There were other girls on the premises. Savile asked her if she wanted to go for a ride in his car, but she refused. 2 days later, he sent her an enormous box of chocolates. Ms. G. Ms. G. informed Surrey police in July 2008 that Savile promised to get her a job at Stoke Mandeville Hospital if she took it out in trade by performing oral sex on him. She refused. She was a former pupil of Duncroft Children's Home. She remembered the staff at the school as being in awe of Savile. He visited constantly, every 6 to 8 weeks. He would request strange things from the girls. He would ask them to comb his hair or massage his shoulders. Ms. B. Ms. B. did not experience an assault firsthand, but she did witness an incident of sexual abuse perpetrated by Jimmy Savile, which she reported to Surrey police. She bore witness as Savile assaulted a teenage girl in the late 1970s. As she recalls, she saw Savile take a girl's hand and put it on his crotch while they were watching television in a darkened room at the school. Ms. B. reported this incident to the police because she was incensed when she saw that Savile was remembered after his death as a national hero. Jane 1. Jane told the BBC that Savile abused her when she was 16 years old. She was a patient at Leeds General Infirmary at the time. He took her to a store to buy sweets and magazines. He had a way of making her feel special, like she was the chosen one. The feeling soon diminished when he sexually assaulted her in the basement of a hospital. Savile's attack was an ambush. One of the hospital's porters led her to an area where Savile was waiting behind a closed door. "He pulled me in immediately and started to kiss me with his tongue," she said. "At the same time, his left hand went on to my right thigh under my dress." The entire incident took 5 to 6 minutes. There wasn't time to draw breath. There wasn't time to analyze even what's happening here because it was seamless. And then he said, "You've got to go." The event was so carefully orchestrated and smoothly executed, it appeared that it was something Savile had done many times before. The assault left her feeling, quote, "dirty and ridiculously stupid." She reported the incident to some nurses. Their reaction? They laughed at her. So much so, she couldn't even bring herself to finish the story. Only her mother believed her. Jane quickly clued into the fact that this behavior of Savile's was no secret at Leeds General Infirmary. "Everybody knew," she said. "All the staff accepted it, patients accepted it, clearly the porters accepted it as well." Jane never kept the assault secret because she knew it was not her fault. Her only regret is that, having seen hundreds of other victims come forward with their own stories, she wishes she had reported Savile's actions to the police. Jane 2. Jane 2 was 10 years old in the late 1970s when she was assaulted by Savile in Leeds General Infirmary. Savile picked her up at her house to take her to the hospital in a small two-seated car, which ensured that her family would have no alternative but to ride in a separate car. Upon their arrival, Savile took her to a room with no windows, where he kissed her repeatedly after her parents left the room. 6 months later, Savile subjected her to more abuse when he picked her up in the same car and took her to another appointment at the hospital. By the time her third appointment was due, she was so terrified of Savile, she deliberately injured herself to avoid returning immediately to Leeds. She was taken to a local hospital. Savile visited her there. As she put it, her experiences with Savile left a, quote, "major and lasting impact" on her. Joe won. At the age of 18, Joe was a patient at Broadmoor Hospital. Saville abused him in the early 1970s. He was told to go to Saville's apartment to collect payment for washing his cars. Once inside, Saville forced him to perform oral sex on him. Joe told Saville he didn't want to, but Saville gave him, quote, no alternative. Joe says he didn't complain at the time, because he was afraid of being labeled a troublemaker and because he was aware of Saville's considerable reputation around the hospital. Ms. E. Ms. E. was abused by Saville repeatedly in the early 1990s. She said Saville, unaccompanied by staff, would sit in the day room and talk with patients. On one occasion, while sitting with his back to the other patients, Saville put his hand on her leg and, still talking to the other patients, moved it upwards and molested her. She froze up, too shocked and terrified to fight him off. Afterwards, she felt guilty. She told a member of the staff after the fact. Their response, they told her she must have imagined it. Saville assaulted her in a similar fashion numerous times over a period of several weeks before another patient piqued his interest and he moved on, whereupon he began to abuse them. Eventually, he would begin abusing her again. This occurred as a cycle, one that would be repeated. She reported that this caused her significant distress. Jane 3. Jane was a patient at Broadmoor in the early 1970s and was assaulted there by Saville. It occurred during a screening of a pre-recorded episode of Top of the Pops at the hospital. Patients watched at the front of the room and staff at the back. A large sofa blocked the view to those at the rear. Saville sat with the patients at the front. He sat next to Jane and put his hands between her legs, whereupon he molested her. This persisted for 2 to 3 minutes. Jane did not feel that she would be able to effectively lodge a complaint at the time for fear of being labeled and punished as a troublemaker. Jane 4. Jane was raped by Saville in 1970 at Digby Hospital in Exeter. She was a married 25-year-old and was admitted to the hospital to be treated for depression. Saville invited her into a motor home on the grounds of the facility. Once inside, he raped her. She didn't report the incident at the time. She has said that it had a deeply traumatic effect on her. Leisha Brooks. Leisha was a normal, happy 8-year-old girl until she met Jimmy Saville. For the following 2 years after that day, she was frequently abused at the BBC. At the age of 50, she was angry Saville's actions robbed her of her innocence and stole her childhood from her. She also felt the amount of compensation she received from the government's Criminal Injuries Compensation Authority, or CICA, was inadequate. She waited nearly 5 years for the CICA's recognition of the treatment she endured from Saville and others. She was assaulted at least 100 times as a regular guest at the BBC's television center. As Leisha said, it works out at just £730 each for all the men who abused me. Is my life worth so little? It's disgusting. A joke. No amount can take the pain away or change what they did. But I'm broken. My life has been destroyed by everything that happened to me as a child. I'm severely psychologically damaged. My story has been proven, and yet here I am, still fighting. I'd probably have got more if I'd been in a car accident. Leisha was one of up to 1,000 victims who were sexually abused at the BBC by Saville, though she reports that up to 30 other men committed similar acts against her. All this began when she was invited by a family friend to spend weekends with him when she was 8. She grew up as a member of a poor family in Muswell Hill, North London. The friend was a set designer and told her he could treat her to a visit to the television center so she could get a look at where the programs were produced and meet some of the BBC's best-known personalities. Autograph book in hand, Leisha wandered around the facility the first time, wide-eyed, likely expecting to be indulged with attention by the BBC's stars. Instead, she was thrown into a pedophile ring. Saville and dozens of associates sexually assaulted her, which usually began by sitting her on their knees. She was signed on as a guest every other weekend. Staff failed to recognize the constant visits of one girl as being a red flag of any kind. The abuse continued until she was 11. In the following years, she attempted suicide over 20 times. Part of the after effects was instability in her romantic relationships. She has had 5 children, but lost custody of all of them. She is so volatile and vulnerable, she has been unable to hold down a job. In the mid-1990s, Leisha served time in prison after she attacked someone's home. She became convinced they had abused one of her own children. The set designer and so-called friend was convicted of child abuse when Leisha was 11. She finally gathered up the courage to report Saville's role in her victimhood when she was 19. She says no actions were taken and the police did not believe her. After his death, when he was exposed as a sexual predator in 2012, she was finally taken seriously. The BBC set up the Dame Janet Smith Review to investigate claims of sexual abuse committed by staff, and Leisha's evidence was included in the report. In the review, Dame Janet said of Leisha, "I accept she was taken to the television center on different occasions and was there abused by Jimmy Savile. She may also have been abused there by other men." Having lived in poverty for much of her life, Leisha received £18,750 from the BBC, though she had to use it to pay off debts. She now lives on £155 a week from disability payments in government housing in Colchester, Essex. A dog is her only companion. She expected that the compensation she awaited from SECA would improve her financial standing considerably. SECA compensates victims of violent crime, including sexual assault. She was informed her award was to be £22,000. However, this would include her original BBC payout, so she ended up with only £3,250. She has often resorted to pawning material items to pay for food. She is resentful that she was victimized by a system that did nothing to stop perverts like Saville from assaulting her and even protected them. And in the end, it was she who struggled to make ends meet. Adding insult to injury, the SECA has awarded higher payouts to people who have not endured anything nearly as bad as what she experienced. In 2016, the SECA gave £136,710 to a teacher who was assaulted by a student in 2010. Another had his payment doubled from £61,561 to £150,613 because he was assaulted at the pupil referral unit where he was teaching. He felt he was entitled to this money because he was psychologically unable to return to work. Leisha's experiences with sexual abuse have not just made it difficult for her to obtain and keep a job. It has ruined her entire life. She has never been able to have a normal life, and her mental health issues continue to worsen over time. As she puts it, "I'm 51 this year, and the abuse started when I was 8 or 9 years old. It's been a long time, and in my head, I've never dealt with it. Now I can't go in crowded places near men. If a man phones me up, I'll put the phone down. I can't be touched by men. I can't go in crowded places near men. If there are men either side of me in a supermarket queue, I have to put my shopping down and leave. It affects my whole life. I went to the police when I was 19, and they refused to proceed because they decided the abuser couldn't possibly be a famous person. There was so much evidence, and no one did anything. The police were supposed to protect me, and they didn't believe me. I feel like because I am an unemployed single woman, I don't count. I've just been ground down over the last 5 years. I just want it all over. You go for decades not being listened to, and then this." Joe, too. At the age of 8 in 1981, Joe was informed by a nurse that somebody special would be visiting. Who should appear from behind the bed curtain but Jimmy Savile? Savile's next move is to place his hand beneath the sheet and place it on Joe's penis over his pajamas. Savile continued to touch it as it became erect and emerged from the crotch of his pajamas. Joe was distressed by this incident and reported it to his mother when she visited shortly thereafter. His mother did not believe him. Jane 5. Jane was a hospital volunteer. She found a pen and sought an autograph from Savile. He invited her to the side of the cafeteria he was standing at. He pinned her up against the counter, and while he signed the autograph, he put his hand up her dress and into her underpants. He penetrated her vagina with his fingers. He withdrew them and wiped his fingers on her legs. This was painful for her as Saville was wearing heavy rings and bracelets. Jane 6. In 1968, Jane visited Stoke Mandeville Hospital as part of an entertainment group. The group was invited to be recorded for an episode of Saville's BBC radio show, Saville's Travels. Before the session was to begin, the group had lunch in a large hall. She was sitting at the end of a table and Saville asked her to get up and sit on his lap. He sat her down, but had his hand positioned so that she could not avoid sitting on it. He put his hand in her panties and digitally penetrated her vaginally. She attempted to get up, but he yanked her by the arm back down and fingered her again. Jane managed to get away from him by asking to go to the washroom. Jane did not report the incident to anyone at the time. Jane 7. In spring of 1973, Jane took her one-year-old son to Stoke Mandeville Hospital for surgery. She was assigned to a side room to stay in close to her son's room. A nurse brought Saville into the room to keep her company and cheer her up. At this point, she was heavily pregnant with her second child. Once the nurse left the room, Saville put his hands on Jane's belly in an attempt to feel the child's limbs move. He then grabbed her breasts and said that she had, quote, a couple of good milk tanks. She shouted at him. For once, he apologized for his harassment. He argued that most ladies like a little fondle. He apologized for a second time and left. Jane 8. Jane was 19 years old at the time when her spine was severed in an accident in August of 1973. She had been in the National Spinal Injury Center for about 8 months. Her run-in with Saville occurred near the end of her stay at the NSIC. Saville took her out for dinner at a restaurant as a way of thanking her for her fundraising work as a patient. While at the restaurant, he stuck his hand up Jane's skirt between the legs and attempted to grope her. It was not easy for her to elude him because she was in a wheelchair. Saville took her back to the hospital in a car that was driven by third party. En route to the NSIC, Saville tried to kiss her and stuck his tongue down her throat. She made it abundantly clear that she didn't want to have relations with him. She felt that it was the presence of the driver that kept the assault from escalating. Once back at the NSIC, she told a nurse about what Saville had done to her. She learned that it was an open secret among the staff at this facility that he was a, quote, sex pest. Jane 9. In April 1981, Jane was invited as a guest to a hospital to present a donation. She was very excited about the opportunity to do this. When she arrived, she was greeted by staff and a camera crew. Saville put his arm around her shoulders. He touched her right breast from the side. He repeated this action with all the other people present. She felt intimidated and wanted to leave. The camera crew persuaded her to pose for a photo with Saville first, on his lap. She complied with this request, and as she sat, Saville slid his hand down the back of her pants and inserted his fingers into her vagina. The camera crew laughed, and she could sense that a conspiracy was afoot. Jane 10. A few days before Jane was discharged from hospital, Saville visited her ward. After they met, he asked her if she had had sex with her boyfriend. When she told him she hadn't, he was ecstatic. Saville suggested that the two of them should have sex. She was in awe of him at the time. He stripped naked and penetrated her, whereupon he ejaculated inside of her. After 15 minutes, he told her she needed to get back to the ward because they would wonder where she went. She never reported the incident to anyone. Jane 11. Jane was a care assistant at the age of 17. She would later undertake nurse training at the same institution and live in residence there. She met Saville there and became involved in his fundraising efforts, which primarily involved taking photos and taking people on tours. Saville was very famous at this point, and she was starstruck. On at least 3 occasions, he asked her to go to his room. At first, this made her feel appreciated and important. As she described it, Saville would just take hold of me and put my hands where he wanted them, or he would remove my clothes, not all of them, and put me in the position he wanted. Each time he had sex with me, he used no protection. He did not seem to care that I may get pregnant. He would instruct me, and I would do as he asked. I don't remember saying no to him. In fact, I don't remember saying anything at all. I remember how awful he smelled, how he would talk while he was doing things to me, and feeling confused when I left with a box of Rose's chocolates in my hand. I would go back to my room and tell my friend what had happened. Other than her friend, she never told anyone what Saville had done to her. Jane, 12. Jane was 16 in the early 1970s when she was admitted to Leeds General Infirmary. Saville approached her and spoke kindly to her, saying, "There's no need for those tears. Uncle Jimmy will sort it." He pushed her trolley into an elevator. They were all alone once the doors closed. He stood beside her at the end of the elevator and fumbled at the back of her neck, attempting to untie her hospital gown. He then put his hands into her gown and fondled her breasts. She wanted to scream, but could make no sound. Jane, 13. Jane won a competition as an aspiring teenage journalist to write about a celebrity. She went to Leeds General Infirmary to request an interview with Jimmy Savile. The request was granted, and they met at a later date. The head porter said, "I'll leave you to it." He shut the door, and a noticeable change came over Savile, as she recalls. His demeanor changed. He wasn't the Jimmy Savile that you saw on the telly, that, you know, you saw at charity events. He just wasn't that sort of man anymore. He changed within. I would have said seconds. His eyes were cold and dead, and he moved his hand. You know, he started that then. I mean, literally, as soon as the door had shut, Savile raped her. Jane, 14. Jane was under the age of 10 when driven alone by Savile to hospital to see a specialist. This is the story as she told it to investigators after Savile's death. "He sat me there and said that he was going to make me pretty. He actually said that it was him that was paying to make me pretty, and that when I grew up, I'd be pretty. He kissed my neck. It wasn't like if your daughter falls or any of your family's children fall, you pick them up and say, 'Come here and let me kiss it better.' It wasn't like that. It was a horrible, slimy kiss." Joe, 3. Joe describes how being assaulted by Savile impacted him psychologically. "He gave me a complex that I was ugly. He gave me a complex that I was never going to be anybody in my life, and he also gave me a complex that it was fine for him to do what he was doing. He doesn't stop winning. He doesn't stop winning at any point. You live with it. Every day now, it's worse now. I'm just happy he's dead, but it's worse now because I just feel like he's laughing now. I just feel he's laughing at us all." Jane, 15. The only formal complaint made was in 1977 by Jane's father. She was 11 years old at the time. Investigators deemed the attack serious and conceded that it should have resulted in Savile being suspended from the hospital and reported to the police. As they later admitted, there can be no excuses made in relation to what was acceptable at the time or how children were perceived. This was a serious allegation and should have been investigated fully, as it was reported to a hospital manager. All parties mentioned in the report, except the victim, are deceased, so Jane is the only one who can give an account as to what happened. She remembers Savile as being like a, quote, king on the wards. During the summer of 1977, she was treated on Ward 7X for skin cancer. She spent 4 months in the hospital and underwent a skin graft. She recalls that the summer was very hot and she was in a treatment room with a young nurse. The nurse was cleaning her wound when Savile popped his head in through an open window because he heard Jane crying. When he entered the room, she was naked from the waist down. The nurse had to leave the room at this point for reasons she did not disclose, and she closed the door. Jane was alone with Savile. According to the report, he gripped her tightly so she could not move and rubbed his penis against her arm. He then tried to penetrate her vagina digitally. She screamed in pain and the nurse returned. Savile left swiftly. Jane was hysterical and crying. Sister Cherry, now dead, came in and told her to be quiet, that Savile would not do such a dreadful thing, and that he raised a great deal of money for the hospital. Jane told her father, now dead, when he came to visit her that evening. She heard angry voices raised between her father and sister Cherry. Her father took the matter to the registrar. Saville did not come near her again. Jane's father decided that due to my ill health, age, and not wishing to distress me further, not to pursue the complaint to its conclusion. Jane 16. Nurses at Barnet General Hospital in London told Jane in 1983 that Saville, quote, liked to have sex with dead bodies. Jane 17. Jane was abused by Saville since the age of 9. While in recovery at a hospital in Leeds, Saville tracked her down and sexually assaulted her again. Saville's repeated attacks left her so traumatized that she avoided treatment for a large birthmark on her face for fear that he would find her again and rape her again. She tried to wash the mark off herself at home with bleach. On occasion, he picked her up in his Rolls Royce and took her for laser surgery at St. James Hospital in Leeds. As she reports it, Saville began to kiss my port wine stain. He nuzzled into my neck and put his hand up my skirt. He continued to abuse her for 3 years. She discontinued the treatments, deciding that living with the birthmark was preferable to risking another encounter with Jimmy Saville. If only bleach were adequate to remove the stain Saville has left on the psyches of his victims. Unfortunately, that's a common affliction for those who are affected by the actions of human monsters.
Something happened that wasn't right. I want a formal acknowledgement of what happened to me. Believed, being believed, is important. It is important.
The relief. I haven't kept it a secret. It's pure and utter relief, and for some reason that has allowed me to start being who I am and want to be.
All the people that matter have believed me. That's a great big thing for me. That's the most important thing.
Good people who listened but didn't hear before are really listening now, and they are hearing.
This isn't just a product of the 70s, and this isn't just something that happened to hundreds of us then. You know, it's still happening.
I think the word compensation is a horrible word. I get very cross with people who portray me as someone who is only doing this for compensation. It's not. It is a recognition. It's... And in Saville, you know, that was all that they were able to achieve. Saville was now dead, so the only remedy they had was to pursue an action against his estate. But what's important is that no one is above the law. Since Saville, people have felt empowered to try and seek justice. People now feel, yeah, I'm not going to sit on this forevermore. I have to do something now. I have to do something in my lifetime while someone can be prosecuted, or I'm going to regret it.
I'm Morgan Rector. Thanks for listening.